Welcome back to Midnight in the Mountains. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you doing, Laura?
I am good, and I am very excited to get into our topic tonight.
I am super excited. When doing a little bit of research for this particular topic, I came across some things I did not know. And I'm looking forward to comparing and contrasting notes with you.
Yep. Same for me, too. So I'm going to start out with basically how this whole winter season, Christmas season, whatever you may celebrate, pretty much came about. All of this stuff pretty much goes back to the sun and the sunlight. And the winter solstice is something that happens every year around the 21st or 22nd in the northern hemisphere. So it's when the earth is tilted the farthest away from the sun, and it causes the longest night of the year with the shortest day. So this day actually marks the halfway point of winter. So then from like this day to every day on, the days start to get a little bit longer, and it's the hope that spring is finally coming. Yule is celebrated from this point on to the beginning of January, and it began in Scandinavia, and they were like the first ones to do this tradition. It is the oldest of the winter solstice festivals, and it is hard to tell when Yule actually started and actually became a thing, but the earliest known written recording of Yule was from a monk named Bede, who was an English monk, and he was England's first historian, and his birthday was in 672 or 673. So that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea how old Yule goes back to. So this was like a joyous time for everybody to celebrate the returning of the sun. Earlier in the winter, before it got colder, they would slaughter a bunch of their cattle because they wouldn't have to worry about finding food for it during the winter. And plus it was cold, so the meat would be stored for the winter and it wouldn't go bad.
It's like having a built-in freezer.
Exactly. And they also made a whole bunch of wine and beer. And by the end of the growing season, when it was starting to get cold out, the wine and beer would be fermented and ready to go. So it was perfect to have this in time to celebrate. And basically, they would just feast all the time and drink the whole time. This was like a time of rebirth, transformation, creativity, and new beginnings. So what they would do was decorate their homes with evergreens. The evergreens symbolized a continuation of life through dark and cold, and they were thought to have magical powers because they could survive the actual harsh cold winter. They also used the evergreens to protect from evil spirits because the prickliness of the plant was placed on doors and fireplaces and like even windows, any kind of access point to get into the home. It was supposed to ward off the evil spirits because of this magical power that it had to be strong and survive, and also the sharpness of the needles was supposed to help keep these evil spirits out of the house. Another tradition that they had was the Yule log. And I really like this one because what they would do was the men would go out with the boys in the family, and they'd go out to the woods and they would carefully select a Yule tree. It was usually a oak tree, which was said to have magical properties to it, or even an ash tree. And it had to be like this special tree that they selected. They wouldn't just chop down any tree. And when they would go out, they would bring wassail with them. And it is Old English, and it means to be well, be hale, or good health. It's a strong drink that is usually a mixture of ale, honey, and spices, or mulled apple cider. And when they would go out to the forest, they would anoint the tree with this wassail, and they would soak cakes in the wassail and offer it to the tree. And it would be this whole ritual. They'd cut down the tree, they would carve Norse runes into the tree, and they would then drag this tree into their house. And so what they did was, I mean, when I've heard of the Yule log before, I always pictured a bunch of people around, you know, a giant log bonfire party outside. Right. But once I was getting into this and researching this, that's not even the case. I kind of love this idea. They would bring the whole freaking log into their house. And through the 12 nights of Yule, they would feed the log into the fire. So each night they would burn a portion of the log and they would like start with the butt end of the log, put it in the fireplace and let it burn. And then each night they'd shove more of it in, but they would keep this log burning. I don't know if I would assume that they would have to add other firewood.
Yeah, because that would be green wood. You know, green wood doesn't burn very well anyways, right?
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. And to go for 12 nights, you would think they'd have to add to it. So they would do this, and they said it was not a good omen if you let the Yule log burn out. And what they did was, every year after the Yule log would burn out, they'd save a piece of it, and they would put it under their bed. And I only found one source that said this, but putting it under their bed was supposed to protect the home from lightning strikes. So they would relight this year's Yule log with the old year Yule tree. It was tradition and it was supposed to bring wellness and good luck. And the other thing is, they would take the ash from the Yule log and they would use it on their plants. I also saw somewhere where it said that they would use it in kind of like rituals or anything that they did during the year. And every night while this Yule log burned, they would get together and they'd socialize and they would drink and just eat food and have a good time.
So it strikes me as kind of interesting that what was left of the Yule log that they put underneath their bed would protect the house from lightning strikes. Because if I'm not mistaken, in Norse mythology, that the main god, or like the biggest god, I believe his name was Odin, I believe. But he was always known to have, no, it was Thor. Because, you know, Thor controlled the lightning strikes. So if they kind of appeased him, you know, with this little offering, that maybe their house wouldn't be struck.
Yeah. And, well, Thor was Odin's
That's
son.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. And it is interesting, too, because if you think about it, like if lightning hits a tree, it gets mm-hmm. charred with charcoal. But I only found that in one source, so I'm not entirely sure what their thought was or where that came from. It was really hard to find information, honestly. Like, I went on so many websites and I was like back checking things. I'd find something and then I'd go back, you know, check it out to see if I could find it somewhere else, because it was really hard to get detailed information on this stuff. One more thing I have with the Yule, I have the Yule tree is another tradition. And this was not a tree that they'd cut down and that they would bring in their house, but rather a tree that they would decorate outside. It was supposed to represent the tree of life, and it was decorated with like natural things, and they would put things on it that they wanted the gods to give them. They would put pine cones on it. They would put berries and other dried fruit. They'd let the birds eat from it, or the wildlife animals eat from it. And that kind of reminds me of, if you've ever watched those, I mean, who hasn't, those old claymation Christmas specials where they have, there's one that sticks out in my head. I think it was like A Year Without a Santa Claus or something. And it tells how Santa Claus came to be. And they have this whole, basically Yule tree, but they call it a Christmas tree in the woods. They decorate it with all this stuff and the birds are there and everything. And it's just kind of something I thought of.
Did it say what kind of tree they use for Yule tree? Was it another oak tree, or did they use like an evergreen? Just out of curiosity.
It was an evergreen, yeah.
That makes sense, yeah. So that would be like, quote unquote, the first Christmas trees. Even though they were outside, they were taking an evergreen tree, they were decorating it.
Yeah.
I mean, as early as, you know, that guy, the monk was 600 or 670 or something like that.
Yeah, 672 or 673, whenever he was born.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, I mean, Yule went back even before
that. Right, yeah,
because
it would have already been a tradition for years and years and years before he would even have heard about it. I mean, before he was even born, because it sounded like it was a fairly established tradition. You know, you had to do this, you had to do this, you had to do this, you know, in a certain order.
Yeah.
The other thing that strikes me a little interesting is, you know, them taking the ash from the Yule log and using it to fertilize, you know, their plants for later on in the year, because it's known that, you know, when you burn wood and you get the ash from it, there's a lot of good chemicals. There's nitrogen in there, there's phosphorus, there's probably a little bit of calcium left over that doesn't get burnt off, and it's good to spread that back into the dirt because it replenishes some of the nutrients the plants take out of it during the year. Thanks, nursery.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah, right? Things mm-hmm. you didn't know, things you learned. Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool too that they did that. Yule's pretty cool.
It is very Norse-like though. Like it feels Norse-like, you know, like a Viking tradition per se.
Yeah. So I have another tradition. We move from Yule to Saturnalia, which was celebrated in Rome. And this is a Roman pagan festival. So now, if any of you have listened to our Valentine's Day origin episode, mm-hmm. yeah. So the Romans were pretty wild, actually. And this sounds like a hell of a lot of fun.
I would go to it.
Oh, me too. I would totally skip their Valentine's Day celebration, but this one I'm in for. Okay, so Saturnalia honors the Saturn god, the god of agriculture, and it is derived from farming-related rituals. It started out as a one-day holiday, but it ended up becoming a week-long festival by 133 to 31 BC. It started on December 17th. And according to the Julian calendar, which the Romans had used, it continued up to December 25th, which the 25th is the date that they considered the winter solstice to be. So a couple days off from the Scandinavians. And during this time, everyone feasted, played games, music, socialized during these times. All the business and schools were closed. They basically had wild parties where the slaves were relieved of their duties and they were offered freedom. They were allowed to partake in celebrations. They were treated as equals. And in some places, they even had their slaves sit at the head of the table and their masters would wait on them. So this was kind of a time where they kind of gave gratitude to their slaves. And just like in Scandinavia, houses were adorned with wreaths, greenery. They took off their traditional togas and they traded them in for colorful ones known as synthesis. During this time, and gifts were given, including candles, the light of a burning candle was supposed to represent the sunlight returning after the winter solstice. Also during this time, there was what they would call a mock king was chosen in the household. And it was usually somebody who was the lower person of the family, not really the person in charge. And they were in charge of causing mischief. They were in charge of insulting house guests, wearing ridiculous clothing, and chasing women around. I also saw another one where there was chasing women around and dancing and singing in the streets naked, and that wouldn't surprise me at all with the Romans. They were wild.
The Romans were very free.
And in the Temple of Saturn, there was a statue, and the statue that they had wool binding on the feet of the god of Saturn. And during these festivals, they would loosen them to symbolize freedom for the god to join into their celebrations. And on the very last day of Saturnalia, terracotta figurines were given to each other, and the figurines were called signalaria. And it's thought that maybe these gifts of these human figurines were referred back to time of human sacrifice. I also read that they were supposed to be figurines of the Saturn god. And eventually all this chaos and everything got pushed down because in the year 306, Constantine became the new Roman emperor and he introduced Christianity. And then there was a point where Christianity was taking over, but they were still celebrating Saturnalia. Saturnalia eventually just became phased out by the Catholic Church because this was, you know, crazy, ungodly thing, so they couldn't have Saturnalia anymore. To add to this, since their winter solstice fell on the calendar of December 25th, and Catholics were trying to get rid of the pagan traditions, the first Christmas took place in 336 AD under Constantine's rule. Around 350 AD, Pope Julius I set December 25th to celebrate that the day Jesus was born. So now we all know that Jesus actually was not born in December. Scholars think that it might have been more sometime in the spring, summertime.
So when I was looking into if Christianity actually co-opted a pagan celebration for Christmas so they could make it their own, a festival that the Romans used was the birthday of Sol Invictus, which is another name. Sol Invictus is another name for the unconquered sun. He's also known as Helios, which is one of the Roman gods. Sol Invictus was one of the several of the sun gods that were worshipped in the Roman Empire. And according to the ancient calendar known as the chronograph, it was celebrated in 354. And his birthday, Sol Invictus' birthday, was celebrated on December 25th, the winter solstice in Rome. One of the interesting things about it, that why they think this may be one of the festivals that Christianity kind of co-opted, was Sol Invictus was a sun god, and Jesus was the son of God. Kind of similar there. From the medieval period onwards, people have speculated that December 25th was selected because of Sol Invictus. The Syrian bishop Jacob Bar Celebi, who died in 1171, so this is a little bit farther on, who celebrated Jesus' birthday on Epiphany, wrote, "The reasons for which the fathers transferred the said solemnity, the nativity, from the 6th of January to the 25th, is that it was the custom of the pagans to celebrate on the same day the feast of the birth of the sun." As a Eastern Christian who celebrated the Nativity and the Epiphany in January, Jacob had a clear motive for undermining the December date. After reading a little bit farther, it's pretty unlikely that they did use Sol Invictus because it only became popular in the 3rd century, say about 300 AD, give or take, mostly because the Christians had been celebrating Christmas before Sol Invictus was a popular thing. So the thought is that, yeah, they're similar, but it's probably not the one they used. To be fair, the Christians back then just kind of took all these Saturnalia, the winter solstice, Sol Invictus, and just kind of rolled them all in together and said, okay, this is what we're going to use. But it wasn't something that happened like just one year. It was like, okay, well, we're going to do it now. This is the culmination of 200 years, 300 years worth of traditions that just kind of, you know, slowly kind of got rolled in together to form what we think of as modern day Christmas.
A few more things to add here in closing out how all of this stuff rolled itself into Christmas. Christmas was declared an official holiday in 529, and like I said before with Saturnalia in Rome, pagan traditions ended up being intertwined into Christmas. So we are going to jump ahead in time to the year 1539 over in Germany. So the pagans would bring evergreen tree limbs inside, but the Germans were the first ones to bring the whole entire tree in the house and decorate it. The very first Christmas tree was recorded in the 16th century, the year 1539, and it was displayed by the Lutherans in the Cathedral of Strasbourg. And the Germans loved their Christmas tree so much that they actually caused deforestation and it became a problem. In the 19th century, around 1880, they actually developed the first artificial trees, and they were made from goose feathers that were dyed green. And then also, over in America, the earliest American Puritans in a colony in Massachusetts banned Christmas and then anything pagan related to this new Christian holiday, that they felt like any kind of celebrating was ungodly. You were not allowed to give gifts. You were not allowed to dress festively, sing. You could not do anything other than go to church and sit in a pew and pray and think about the birth of Christ. You could actually get fined if you were caught doing any of these kind of things. Even decorating. You could not decorate your house for Christmas. Eventually, this kind of just fell through. The 18th century, there was an influx of Germans to America, which was particularly in Pennsylvania, which is where you get your Pennsylvania Dutch people. They were the first ones to bring Christmas trees indoors, and they spread the tradition of having Christmas trees in America. And the first tree to be displayed inside in America was in 1830.
Checking out Christmas and some of the origins of Christmas, I came across a site that kind of laid out the different versions of Santa Claus and how we kind of got to what our modern Santa Claus looks like. You know, the one that you think of that you see all the place, you know, big belly, red fur coat, a beard. The original Saint Nick, as in picture form, according to the site, was actually a gaunt, bald, barefoot, and decked out in ecclesiastical robes, complete with a halo over his head. This version of St. Nicholas looks nothing like the jolly fat man that we know as Santa Claus. But in fact, this was the first image of the character in the United States. It was commissioned by New York Historical Society co-founder John Pintard. And it was an image that was meant to help the attendees venerate this virtuous patron saint of sailors and travelers. And in the show notes, I'll link the website so you can go through and look at these pictures, because you really need to look at them to really kind of appreciate how much he's really changed. So the next version that came out would have been the birch stick Santa. So this Santa Claus appears in the first known picture book featuring the character in 1821. He rides a sleigh driven by a single reindeer, and instead of a halo, he now wears a furry hat and a smile. But lest one think that the guy's all fun, he also holds a stick in his right hand. Santa was still chiefly a disciplinarian who leaves a, quote, long black birchen rod, end quote, in children's stockings, urging parents to use it, quote, when virtue's path his sons refuse, end quote. So basically, this version of Santa Claus would carry a large birchen stick, put it in children's stockings so that if they were not virtuous, the parents could use the rod on them. A little weird, but that's okay. Once again, if you look at the photo, you can see that he's very similar to the one before it, but he does have his differences. The next one, this would be in 1838, and this one is much more mischievous, like a goofy version of Saint Nick. He smoked a clay pipe. He would lay like a finger beside his nose, whereas some of you know that's how he gets up and down the chimney. You know, he touches his nose. This time they put him in a flying wagon instead of a sleigh, and it's just a next step into our more modern day Santa Claus. P.T. Barnum of Barnum and Bailey, he had his own particular version of Santa Claus. This would have been in 1850. The pamphlet describes Santa as a fellow with a pockets full of presents who flies down the chimney, but Little Ounce resembles the modern Santa Claus. He wears a three-cornered hat and looks like an 18th century patriot. He rides with Lind on a broomstick and goes up to the mountain declaring, "I am dancing a jig, I am having a freak." Those are P.T.'s words, not mine. But it does kind of reflect that, you know, a lot of people had their own views on what Santa Claus was. The next one that I found was going to be in 1863. So this one was kind of different because this would have been during the Civil War, the American Civil War. And this one was made by Thomas Nast, who is also the creator of the elephant as a symbol for the Republican Party. And he's known as one of the greatest political cartoonists in American history. Nast drew the annual Christmas illustration for Harper's Weekly, featuring the jolly Santa engaged in all sorts of activities, taking phone calls, bringing gifts to Union soldiers, or racing Mother Goose. Popularity and wide circulation of these illustrations has led to Nast being credited as the one person who firmed up the modern image of Santa. But not all of his work looked like the figure we recognize today. In a number of illustrations, Santa is very short, taking the elf descriptions to heart. So that was the main one there. Basically, that he showed him as kind of an elf-like size instead of his what I think of Santa Claus as being a 6 foot tall jolly man. The next one, this would be about the 1900s. So we're about 40 years farther on. Says, by the 20th century, Santa's personality and characteristics were largely defined. A little bit has been said about his past. By the 1900s, Santa Claus was so far removed from his religious backings that he merited an origin story all of his own. The man who wrote The Wizard of Oz, which would be Frank Baum, took a crack at it in 1902 with The Life and Adventures of Santa Claus, offering up an imaginative biography of the North Pole dweller. He describes how Baby Claus was found abandoned in the Forest of Breeze, was adapted by Ak, the Master Woodsman, and kidnapped by the evil army of Aguas. And he also befriended the reindeer Flossie and Glossy. It's a really weird tale and includes a lot of illustrations as Santa is an infant young man dressed more like Fred Flintstone than Saint Nick. I've never heard of those, but the picture is super cool to go along with that one. The next one on this particular list was Santa and his flying machines. So in the late 19th century and early 20th century, so we're thinking like 1910 to 1920, an issue of Science and Invention depicted a radio-obsessed boy dreaming of Santa arriving with gifts of radio parts and an elaborate contraption resembling a blimp. There's also another one in 1908 that shows him, instead of using a sleigh, to use a hot air balloon. And so that was kind of how he moved along with the times almost, you know, because in the early 20th century, we would have been having, you know, the telegraph and a lot of different inventions were happening there. Now, this one right here is probably my favorite one. If you don't look at any other pictures, you have to look at these ones. So this is sexy Santa Claus. So in the earliest, this was, what? Yeah, I can't even make this stuff up. It was an illustration done by Puck, which is a magazine that was published out of New York City in the earliest 20th century. It featured Santa on their cover a number of times, and he looks like the character that we would think of Santa Claus. However, it's not the unusual part's not how he looks, but what he's doing. So the illustration is as he's enjoying the affections of two beautiful women who look nothing like Mrs. Claus. In another from Christmas of 1905, Santa Claus is getting up close and personal with a very comely blonde. So if you don't look at any other ones, these ones are absolutely hilarious. I love looking at them. and there's two more after that. But when I looked at the pictures, it's kind of weird. One of them is Santa Claus with a gun. It's from the same magazine, Puck. But in 1912, there was kind of a society for prevention of useless giving, and one of our presidents was actually a part of this society, but they protested the expectation that individuals were supposed to buy gifts for an ever-expanding list of friends, families, acquaintances. So they had Santa Claus look kind of like, you shouldn't do this. And he has this huge, it looks like an Acme revolver from like the cartoons. Like, it's very exaggerated. It's kind of out there, but it's still kind of interesting. And then the last one I have to talk about is when you look up who invented Santa Claus, Coca-Cola is tied into Santa Claus pretty closely. And even though, I mean, you can't credit Coca-Cola for splashing his image all over the place. And they chose the fat guy with the red coat, with the fur on it. They're the one that really popularized it. But he wasn't the only one. Marlboro, the cigarette company, did it. Camel did it. A lot of tobacco companies used Santa Claus as a pitchman back in the early 20th century. I don't think we would ever see that these days. Probably not. But yeah, kind of interesting that way. Yeah, they would never let it be credited to kids that way because, you know, Santa Claus is kind of a kid holiday per se. But yeah, I mean, it's mm-hmm. really fun. Like I said, check the show notes. Definitely look at the sexy Santa Claus. Absolutely hilarious.
I was not expecting you to say that at all.
Laura, you have to look at them. I'm listening to you. As soon as we get done here, you have to check these out. They are absolutely hilarious.
The one when you were talking about Santa Claus with a gun, all I could think about was the Santa Claus movie with Tim Allen when he's at the board meeting with his boss, and he's like, the boss brings out the, what do you call it? The board with the display of what they're going to do for Christmas this year. And he goes, this year we're going total tank. And Tim Allen's like, no, no, no.
That's
like
a pretty good one. Yeah.
Fit. It's like he should be fat and jolly and round. Where's the elves?
Gotta have the reindeer.
Flossy, and the reindeer.
From way back in the...
Oh, God. I would expect nothing less from the person who wrote Wizard of Oz. I hate that movie. It's so creepy. Yes. My sister, it is her favorite movie ever, and I can't stand it. It creeps me out so bad.
So a little bit of trivia for you. I actually played the wizard in The Wizard of Oz for a play when I was in drama class.
Didn't you tell me that before when it had something to do with another episode we were doing?
Yeah, I think something about we had talked short. About that before. And yeah, because I was picked because I was the shortest guy in drama class.
But how did that tie into our subject?
I can't remember. I can't remember if we talked about an episode or if I mentioned to it because of something else, like talking off the podcast. Mm-mm.
Yeah, I don't. I feel like it wasn't an episode, but I don't know. I'm not going back to listen. So, yeah. So that was really cool. I've never heard of that list or even seen that list, and I can't wait to get the link to see it. The tricorn hat thing was really strange. And then you said there was one where he was riding on a broom?
Yeah. Some of the earlier ones, they really kind of stretched it out where they were kind of trying to define. And, you know, once again, this was over like 100 years or, you know, 75 years.
That makes sense.
Where, you know, they just try different things and you know, eventually one of them would become popular. And that's kind of what we ended up with today.
So going off of that, you had spoke about a Santa Claus with a... basically a birch stick, that ties into Krampus, and that also ties into the Belschnickel, which is a Pennsylvania Dutch kind of Santa Claus-like person. So on our next episode, I think that we should go into that. We can go into the Christmas monsters and some of the other Christmas figures.
I like that idea. I like it a lot. Yeah,
there's some real cool stuff, real cool folklore, some creepy things. Definitely, it's not just Halloween that's scary.
It sounds like it's right up our alley, too.
To finish this episode out and wrap it up, I'm going to go back into Yule and some of the things that Christmas has taken from Yule is there are candles used for Christmas in church services. And what the candles were used for, if you celebrate Yule or when people would celebrate it, they were another way to have an eternal flame within the home. And they symbolize light and warmth of the sun and were used to chase away evils and lure back the returning sun. I have this list up, so I'm just going to read from this list. The next one is wreaths. Wreaths were traditional in ancient times, for they symbolized the wheel of the year and the completion of another cycle. They were made from evergreens and adorned with cones and berries and hung as a decoration throughout the home. They were also given as gifts to symbolize the infinity of goodwill, friendship, and joyfulness. So that also ties into what I was talking about before, how the evergreen would also keep away evil spirits too. So the next one on the list here is bells. Now, do you know why jingle bells are a thing?
My guess would be, and I don't know the answer. I'm going to take a wild stab at it. I would assume that the sound of bells scares off ghostly spirits.
You are correct.
What do I win?
I'd say a pat on the back, but I can't reach you. So,
how about a gold star?
There you go. Gold star. I'll mail you one. So, bells were often rung during the winter solstice to drive away demons that surfaced during the dark time of the year. They were rung in the morning as everyone began to wake to chase away the dark days and herald in the warmer, brighter days following the solstice. Next one is elves. They became associated with Yule because the ancients knew that the spirit that created the sun inhabited the land of elves. By including elves in the Yule celebrations, the ancients believed they were assuring the elves' assistance in the return of the sun. Gingerbread. Gingerbread was considered to be a specialty bread during this time, since ginger had not been available until the Crusaders brought it back in the 11th century. There were strict laws regarding specialty breads in that time, so gingerbread was only allowed to be produced during the holidays, and thus it became associated with winter and Yule. I didn't know that one. That's pretty cool.
I didn't know that one either. Yeah, that's very interesting.
We also talked about wassail, which I had said before derives from Old English, which means be well, be hale, or good health. It's a strong drink, usually a mixture of ale, honey, and spices, or mulled apple cider. And they would drink this, and at home, the wassail would be poured into large bowls during the feast time, and the host, when greeting his or her guests, would lift a drink and wish them wassail, to which they would reply, drink hale, which meant drink and be well.
So I'd never heard of that one either. But then when you said that, it reminded me of the song, A Wassailing We Will Go.
Yeah, I never knew that it was a drink like that. And I actually wouldn't mind trying to make that because it sounds pretty good.
It sounds like mead almost.
Yeah, I had seen where mead was mentioned in some of the stuff. The next one I have is caroling. It is a popular Yule tradition when young children honored the winter solstice with song. They would go through villages, sing door to door. The villagers, in return, would reward them with tokens and sweets and small gifts, which symbolize the food and prosperity given by the mother goddess to all her earthly children. Some of the nature symbols of Yule are holly, oak, mistletoe, ivy, evergreens, laurel, bayberry, blessed thistle, frankincense, pine, sage, and yellow cedar. And what they have listed for food and drink of Yule is Yule log cake, gingerbread, fruits, berries, nuts, pork dishes, turkey, eggnog, ginger, tea, spiced cider, and wassail. Colors of Yule are red, green, white, silver, and gold. And that's what I have for the traditions of Yule. And you can see where a lot of these things tie back into holiday traditions that we celebrate today.
Yeah, it's kind of funny how they've, you know, even though that was so long ago, how some of those, we still use some of those same things.
Yeah.
You know, 1500 years later.
I really like to learn where things come from and why they did it. And now you know, I didn't know before, why did we have gingerbread? Why do we decorate with evergreens other than the fact that it just looks pretty?
Yeah, no, that's really, definitely have learned some interesting facts on this particular episode.
I think that's all we got for this one. I cannot wait to jump into the next episode and get into some research for that.
It's going to be an all new experience for me because I don't know any. I mean, I've heard some of the names, but I don't know any origin or anything behind it. So I'm going to have to put my thinking cap on.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah, I think you'll like it. So it'd be fun to get back into it and get some more stuff into it.
Let's see what I can find. I usually find some really weird stuff to throw in there.
To wrap this up, you guys, if you would like to share your stories with us so that we could read them on a podcast, email us at midnight_inthemountains@yahoo.com. I will put the Instagram link in the show notes, as always. And we will talk to you later on.
And don't forget, look at the sexy Santa Claus. It'll give you a good laugh.
See you guys later.